Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, yesterday our bad martini was related to the story of Phil Mickelson. Not that Phil Mickelson was upset with the prospect of paying 62 or 63% of his income in taxes in a variety of forms, but the fact that taxes are that high in some states like California where he lives, and the fact that he got so much blowback from people all over the spectrum, mostly on the left, saying, well, you still have tens of millions of dollars that you're taking home. What are you complaining about? Which is exactly the problem with the liberal perspective on all of this. And but Phil, in our good martini today, gets a shot in the arm from an unlikely source, Tiger Woods. The next tournament on the PGA Tour is at La Jolla out there in California. It used to be the Buick Open. Now I think it's Farmers Insurance. And one of the reporters asked Tiger about Phil's concern over high taxes. And I think he gave an answer most people weren't expecting.
I moved out of here back in, what, 96, for that reason. And I enjoy Florida, but it's also I understand what he was, I think, trying to say.
Wonder if we'll see the same type of reaction over something Tiger Woods did 17 years ago. He obviously did it in a little more quieter fashion, Jim. But the fact that Phil's got some support from the most famous golfer in the world on this issue perhaps gives him a little more of a ground to stand on. Not that he should need any more.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts here. First of all, shame on you, Pete Wilson, the governor of California back in the mid-90s. If what the California tax rates in the mid-90s were bad enough to chase out Tiger Woods, you can only imagine, you know, it's not surprising you're seeing other California residents who can afford to moving out to other more tax-friendly environments. By the way, I should emphasize, for the sake of all listeners, but in particular, Mrs. Garrity and Mrs. Corumbus, the view on state tax policy is the only part of Tiger Woods' lifestyle we are endorsing or saying is a good martini today.
Amen.
Just that one, just that aspect, one small slice of the Tiger Woods experience, shall we say. But this kind of further illustrates a point that a lot of folks who are fans of tax hikes don't like to think too seriously about, which is that people who can afford to will vote with their feet by moving elsewhere. And yes, you know, California is a wonderful place and lots of wonderful, you know, nice communities to live in. But there are other states that also have nice places. And when you're wealthy enough, one, you can afford to have multiple residences and, you know, you can have one for tax purposes and, you know, spend some time in others. And some states are very vigilant about enforcing those sorts of things and others are less so. But basically, you don't have this inviolatable right to every resident. That if a state government starts giving people really lousy value for the taxes they pay, they're going to leave. And that's what we're seeing in California. And Mickelson just, you know, acknowledged it in a way that folks in California didn't want to hear. Well, guess what, folks? Whether or not you want to hear it, people who have to pay those 61, 62, 63 total percentage tax rates on their, you know, highest incomes are going to say, to heck with it. I'll go live somewhere else. That, you know, as nice as the state is, I'll find another place. And what it comes into is this state governments begin to see their residents as people to be fleeced, as natural resources in which they should be trying to extract as much money out of as possible. And the answer is that, you know, the real problem is not so much the rich folks, it's the middle class and lower folks who maybe they don't have the higher tax rates that have been imposed on the highest in earners, but who still find a very high cost of living in places like that. People will, you know, vote with their feet if they can afford to. And you got to wonder how many folks in California are still there out of choice, still there because they still believe in the future of the state. And how many are there just out of the status quo that they just can't afford to move anywhere else, particularly with how badly the housing market's been hit out there. So Tiger Woods, not usually the role model we want to point to, but just going to observe a basic economic reality that competitive tax rates matter. And after a while, a state can price itself out of the market of having wealthy people live there.
And Tiger Woods obviously spends a lot of money. We won't delve into what he spends that money on, but he's spending it in Florida and in other places that aren't California, and businesses suffer. You can't hire, people can't find work, and it just snowballs because the people who pump money into the economy are the people who are fed up with being punished, essentially, for their success. And ultimately, that has had a major effect on California. It's why they're in a fiscal mess and why it's only going to get worse as rational people continue to exodus the state. So very good, Tiger Woods. I didn't think I'd be saying those words today, but well done. Well done. All right, on to martini number two now. And Jim, after a variety of health-related and other political-related delays. Hillary Clinton finally testifying on Benghazi. She's doing the Senate testimony this morning and will be on the House side later today. And here is what you're going to see a lot of later today. Hillary Clinton being questioned in this clip by Wisconsin Republican Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson wanting to know why, when it was blatantly obvious that Benghazi was not the result of some impromptu protest over a video or in reaction to a protest in Egypt, that this was a planned terrorist assault, why the State Department and why the Obama administration tried to hide that fact and essentially lie about it for the longest time. Listen to Hillary's response here.
Again, we were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But
and the American people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
It was actually neither of those, Secretary Clinton. And the fact that you can't just admit it and then move on to whatever discussion.
Your hypothetical example includes two wrong options. Well, first of all, that is the video clip that we'll be playing a lot of. And I was kind of – it struck me – I mean, listeners know where the point of view you and I are coming from, Greg. But that struck me as a terrible answer, because if something terrible happens, like the killing of four Americans, you want to know – why, so you can stop it the next time. If your assessment of the motive is X and it turns out to be Y, or what happened was scenario A and it turns out to be scenario B, well, you have a much less likely chance of preventing the next time because you've assessed the cause incorrectly. The slogan for the Obama White House for the next 4 years is, what difference does it make? Well, it makes a big difference. Now, there are two very things that are depressing about this. One is that she would be bold enough to assert this. I mean, this is the biggest rebuke to the concept of accountability since Nixon said when the president does it, it's not illegal. And then on top of that, for those following, watching the reaction to the testimony on Twitter, a whole lot of liberal journalists were like, yeah, boy, you tell her, Secretary Clinton, you go, girl. Ludicrously enthusiastic that what difference does it make, the reasoning behind the attack is a totally acceptable response to the, clear-cut evidence the administration lied about why it's been for the first 4 or 5 days.
I don't understand it, because then she followed that up with the exact thing you just mentioned. She says, what difference does it make? There were four dead Americans. We want to make sure it doesn't happen again. So if you have no idea what happened or won't admit what happened, how can you possibly prevent it from happening again? Just completely bizarre, but we've come to expect it from the Clintons, and I think this will probably make John Kerry's confirmation process even smoother after this performance today, because nobody's...
I mean, there's one other thing which, we can talk about a good aftertaste to a bad martini. I've always been a skeptical of the Hillary 2016 talk. I look at this woman and see someone who is very tired from an exhausting 4 years as Secretary of State. We saw the issue of the blood clot, the concussion, potential health issues. If elected president in 2016, she would be the oldest president since Ronald Reagan, the same age he is when he took office. I'm skeptical she's going to run. I don't think she's doing herself many favors today. And I look at this and I don't see a bold, energetic, ambitious, aspiring president behind that table. I think she's actually ready to leave Washington and put all this behind her. Because she certainly does not seem to be enjoying this. And as you saw that, I mean, it seemed like a very calculated flash of anger, but I still think the why of this attack doesn't matter at a hearing that's all about the why of the attack. I don't think it's going to turn out well for her. So maybe that's one good aspect of an otherwise outrageous performance that makes up our bad martini.
All right, on to the crazy martini now. And Jim, we were just mentioning before we started here, the odds of David Arquette ever being mentioned in the three martini lunch. That had to be very unlikely odds, and so if you ever bet on that, you're about to cash in big time here, because David Arquette was at one of these inaugural parties. I think it was sponsored by the Creative Coalition, and the Daily Caller interviewed him about gun control, and eventually the conversation got around to, what would you like to see Hollywood's role be in promoting less gun violence? And here's what Arquette had to say.
If you want to, restrict the amount of bullets that fit in a magazine and then restrict that also from being able to show that amount of bullets in a clip on a movie screen, I'm totally down with it.
You know how many times I have to reload with the 7 or 10 bullet magazines, Jim? That would just go on forever.
I mean, when you said, hey, let's make David Arquette our crazy martini today, Greg, I just kind of thought you meant in general, just for being David Arquette. But that assessment, that one of the effective tools against gun violence would be to show smaller capacity magazines in movies, also stands up there as one of the more inane assessments I've ever taken. Something that came up in my research of the magazine issue and stuff like that. Greg, I don't know if you're familiar with the Glock 17, I believe is the name of it. It's the most popular handgun in the country. It is, you know, has 17 shots. That's the name Glock 17. Or maybe it was a Glock 19, maybe I'm thinking of. But anyway, the bottom line, it's the most, you know, popular handgun. And you look at it and you've seen it in like a million cop movies. It is also featured in the cinematic masterpiece Die Hard 2, well known as the moment when Senator Fred Thompson helped resolve the hostage crisis at Dulles Airport back in the early 90s.
Yes.
And there's an entire monologue that the John McClane character gives about the type of gun that the bad guys use. It's a Glock 19. It's made in West Germany. It's all plastic. It doesn't show up in a metal detector. And all of it is totally false. Like, if this was a screenwriter who knew, like, almost nothing about guns. There is no such thing as a plastic gun that can slip through airport security or anything like that. Oh, then it costs as much as a cop makes in a month and all kinds of stuff. So one of the things kind of fascinating is it struck me as one of the all-time great examples of how Hollywood, or at least a lot of screenwriters and creative types in Hollywood, don't really understand much about guns. But the interesting thing is that they can really sound like they know what they're talking about when it comes to guns. Because in part of that, this is one of the things that has made the Glock such a popular handgun. Now, apparently it's also a very good handgun and lots of people like it and you know, it's a good quality and all these other things. But it always struck me as a really kind of funny example of when you talk about this popularity of this handgun, this late 90s, you know, this was one of the first times it was depicted on the silver screen and it was introduced to the audience in a way that is completely and totally false. So Hollywood, I can't really turn to you for any type of policy advice on almost any issue, but particularly not guns, I think. And even if I had to turn to anybody in Hollywood, I think David Arquette is among the very last people I would turn to for policy advice.
Just makes me wonder what they'll be using in Die Hard 5 coming up on Valentine's Day, which is fabulous.
Kalashnikovs. Apparently it's all taking place in Russia because, you know, Greg, haven't you and I said, boy, we need a fifth Die Hard movie and it needs to be in Russia, you know. So. They have splinters from their hands scraping the bottom of the barrel. And I say this as a guy who really liked like 3/4 of the preceding Die Hard movies.
Yeah, same here. Absolutely. Die Hard 1, perhaps the greatest action movie of all time, in my opinion.
And so. A great, great Christmas film. Nothing captures the spirit of the season.
You know? Really, really does. Jim, have a fabulous day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.